Hey everybody, it's Nolan North, you know, Nathan Drake from Uncharted, and you're listening to the Geek Apocalypse podcast.
Hello everybody and welcome to the latest episode of the Geek Apocalypse podcast with yours truly, Mr. Stephen Hesse. Thank you so much for checking out the latest episode. And first of all, the news, as in an update on my situation, that I need to apologize for the lack of episodes over the last 2.5 weeks or so. That is due to the fact that I've had some stuff to deal with in relation to a few things in my personal life, including having some sort of issue with the just stuff in general. Like, you know, I don't want to bore you by getting into stuff. So there has been a slight delay in getting, in particular, this episode up, which is kind of an extra episode because this is with Manu Interami, who I hope I'm saying his surname right. He corrected me a couple of times in the episode. Who is E-Chef in Star Trek Voyager, who actually sent me an email requesting to be on, which obviously is really cool. We do get requests to be on the podcast, but being that I'm a huge Star Trek Voyager fan, which episode of this podcast already know, I was a little overwhelmed, shall we say, when I read the invitation. So yeah, so he was obviously E-Chef in Star Trek Voyager, which we spend a decent period of time talking about, but he's on to talk about the Circuit Kickstarter, which he is in the process of producing and involved in the whole process of making it. The basic premise of the Circuit is the idea of taking different genres and stories written by the actual fans themselves, who help kickstart the show to be made, and it's set inside a convention. So the idea is you might have an episode set as a Western in a convention, or a sci-fi, or a drama, or whatever it may be, whatever sort of idea or topic or genre that they come up with, and they will film it with a bunch of well-known people, like, you know, Goran Nemec from Stargate SG-1, I think some people from Farscape, a lot of people from Star Trek Voyager, like Tim Russ and Ethan Phillips, and Armin Shimerman. There's a Robert Picardo, I believe, as well. If you go on the Circuit Kickstarter, which will be a link in the description, wherever you're listening to this, you can find more information, and it has a whole list of casts on the front of who's involved in it, and it sounds pretty awesome. So he came on to talk about that. We obviously talk about Star Trek Voyager in terms of his experience working on it for 11 or so episodes of being E-Chef, and about working with Jerry Ryan, working on the J. Edgar film with Clint Eastwood and Leonardo DiCaprio. He tells some fun stories about that, how he got involved in the business. We did this like really early in the morning with the time difference, so he was very much like, he was very funny, and I really enjoyed interviewing him. We obviously talk about like him getting involved in the business. He's did some stuff before Voyager, like we talk about his sort of career in quite an honest sense. So you know, he's really willing to talk about anything, which I really liked. So he's welcome back anytime. So yeah, please do check out the Circuit. Obviously check out other episodes of this podcast, and thank you so much for listening. If you're listening on iTunes, please do just consider subscribing and follow us on Twitter, which is @geek_apocalypse. But this is the episode with Manu Interami. Enjoy. Manu, who was E-Chef in Star Trek Voyager. How do you say your surname? I probably should ask you this before we started, but let's go with it.
Yeah, it's Interami. Manu Interami.
Okay, so I'll ask him to say his surname from now on, because you say, I forgot to tell you, Manu, I'm incredibly dyslexic. So when I saw your name, I was just like, I'm going to have to ask him and tell him to say it. So
it looks really difficult, but it's just same vowel sound, Interami.
Okay, Interami. Thank you for saying that. That's the better way for me to understand it, being dyslexic, so thank you. Interami. Okay. Huge thank you for joining the podcast. I'm really excited because I showed Manu, for people who are listening, you'll know this already, that I'm a huge Star Trek Voyager fan, and showed him my tattoo, which I got a very nice response, which I'm grateful for. So obviously,
Done. It's a very well done tattoo. Not only that it's Voyager, but it's also well executed.
Thank you very much. Sure. I got it done in London, because we were actually talking Just because it's kind of fun to start with this. Have you been to England before?
Yeah, a number of times. One of my favorite places.
Okay.
I'm from Los Angeles, where it's always hot, sunshine. Mm-hmm. I've got Irish blood, so yes. I hate the sunshine. I'm a big fan of, like, 60 degrees and fog and cappuccinos and trains and fresh baked bread. And I love being on that continent. Is it a continent? It's an island. I love being on that island.
The British Isles.
It's just phenomenal there. You can... Americans, we don't have any sense of history, really. Culturally, we knock everything down, and we have, you know, history underneath our feet. And I love being, I've been all over. I've been to Scotland, I've been to Ireland, I've been all over England a number of different times. And I would live there if I could figure out how to make a living and maybe find a nice English girl to marry me, a green card.
But also, we were talking, unfortunately, you haven't been to the north of England. Is that just on your list? Do you just pass through it? Or
no, I mean, you know what's... I'm just a really dumb traveler, so I'll go to places and I won't know where I am. It's very possible that I have been to the north of England. I haven't been to Newcastle.
Okay.
But I have been up... I'm just geography moron, so I've been all around the country. I just don't know where... Whether I was in the south or the north, I'm not sure.
I don't know. I mean, I'm from like a working class area of Newcastle, so you could probably make that argument. I'm not a great at geography either, so I've probably been to places in England that I don't know I've been to. So
Is Wales like farther north than northern England?
Sorry, say that again?
Is Wales farther north than northern
England? Wales is to the west of, it's to the west of like London, so it's very, southwest. I'd say southwest is the, I would say, from where I am, it's the southwest. But in general, like if you look to the British Isles, that Wales is to the southwest. It's on the west coast of England. But yeah, Newcastle is probably the biggest city you can get to in the north before you reach Scotland. Because there's a place called Berwick near here where that used to be. If you ever like read stories about historical battles between Scotland and England, the old joke used to be it wasn't between Scotland and England, it was to fight over the town of Berwick, because it's changed hands several times during air battles. So
cool.
But anyway, though, it's completely off topic, but what was the first time you actually went, what was the reason you went to England for the first time? Was it for a convention?
No, the first time I went to England, I was, I want to say either 6 or 8 years old, and my hippie parents were over there just being hippie travelers.
Mm-hmm.
I don't much remember of that time. The first time that I came over on my own volition, I was 16, and I came with my cousin who just he got hit by a car. And so we got a bunch of insurance money, and and he decided to take a trip, and he wanted someone to accompany him. So we went to London, we went to Amsterdam. But I remember what's kind of been cool about, you know, my whole experience with London is I have a picture of me at like 16 years old at outside of, oh, come on, Mommy, where's your brain? The Poets Hall. Westminster Abbey.
Okay,
so I got a picture of me at Westminster, like at 16, at 20, at 25, at 30, at 35, taking, you know, the same position, same place, just, you know, 5 years later. And I've always been sort of blown away by, I just find there's a surrealness to visiting a place that you have some kind of a connection to years apart in your lifetime.
Yeah, yeah.
And I always love if I come back to a place to get a picture in the same location and know that it's a completely different life that you're living. You're a completely different person, but you're in that same location. And that's sort of what I love about England, is that you can feel the culture and the history beneath your feet. That we've been traveling around there for a long time as a species.
Yeah, that's true. I think I was trying to remember, as you said, as we first started talking about, that we have a lot of like sort of cultural heritage, obviously in the UK in particular. And I'm trying to remember which comedian said the problem with America is there's no like object or thing that like goes earlier than like 1850. Yeah. Whereas over here, it's like the 16th century or 13th century, like, castle that's still... I mean, I'm from Newcastle, which is obviously because there's a castle in it. I mean, that's one of the things that Americans find bizarre, is that there's loads of castles everywhere here. That actually is kind of true. So it must be nice for you, like, because you said about visiting Westminster Abbey. That must have been fun for an American to see.
I love all of it. I'm a really spiritual person, but I'm not a big Christian. Mm-hmm. But I love the cathedrals. I love the history. I love the churches, the museums, just the architecture in and of itself. The way that in Europe in general, and not just England, but your towns, cobblestone streets, way that they're laid out, they tend to service. America's all go, go, go. And there's not, when you go to the town square, mm-hmm. I love that in a lot of towns there, especially the smaller towns, you can actually walk around without cars whizzing by you because the town is built in that fashion.
Exactly, yeah.
And you can get a sense that, you get a sense that you're a part of something that goes way back. You just don't get it in America. We've got McDonald's and we killed Indians and we have a statue from the French. Did the French give us that statue?
It's a bit like, I talked to this about when J.J. Hertzer was on, I was talking to him a little bit about politics, and I guess whenever I hear Americans, because we've had several Americans on, I was telling Manu this earlier, if we ever talk about, you know, your sort of history of where you guys came from, and just whenever I see, like, you know, I watch Bill Maher's show a little bit, and when I watch that and hear you talk about, like, oh, what is an American and what isn't, and where people are from, I just kind of go, didn't you all realize that you kind of took this land from somebody else, and we're all from Africa if you want to go further enough back. I just find it very bizarre that, you know, like, is it Arizona that had, like, a legislation put in where they basically stopped certain, you know, people from getting into...
Oh, it's disgusting. Yeah. The state of things now is, like, it's really scary, you mm-hmm. know? With building walls around the state of California.
Yeah.
Black. And we've always been an imperialist nation from the get-go.
You know?
It's just sort of gotten worse and worse and worse, and there's been little battles in between. And honestly, like, I'm a big conspiracy theory guy.
All right.
I even hate that word because I think conspiracy theory was invented by the CIA to make guys like me sound crazy when they talk.
For questioning things. I agree to you to a certain extent, yeah.
But, you know, me and you, America and Britain fairly have been in bed together for a while with the imperialist kind of style. Mm-hmm. I just think the fact that you guys' money is worth a buck and a half of ours means who's really running the show. I mean, you guys are running the show. We just have a big army, and we pretend that it's so crazy.
Are we a bit like, so you're basically saying, I often like joking about these things, so you're basically saying we're almost like the smaller brother, and you're like the big brother of us, but we just happen to have found a better job and a better mortgage and a better...
and your whole country's more educated. the queen owns half the world, and so you happen to be an island, but you also own, like, the rest of the planet.
I dispute that, but I see where you're coming from.
Yeah.
That's cool.
You know, there's four banks in existence now. You know, the more we go back, it's like they've always been owned by the Rockefellers and the Rothschilds. And I'm guessing Rothschild is a British name. Sounds like a British name.
I'm not quite sure, but it does sound like it, yeah.
Yeah, and those guys own the world. So.
Yeah. Well, I wanted to ask you then, because, so let's get into, I've never been to America. I would love to. I've had several invitations to go. So being as someone that you're based in LA, right?
Mm-hmm. I am.
How would you so let's play the game of I am planning on going to LA. How would you describe, like, living there and the experience of going to that city?
Los Angeles is the most amazing, it's a sprawling Oasis, it's huge. It's, mm-hmm. it takes up, it's one of the, I think the biggest city in the country, but it's flat and it's spread out and it's a big, it's, if you don't have a car here, and sort of in America in general, we ripped up all of our trains. That's another thing I love about Europe and England.
Yeah.
The train systems, the public transpo is, we've become a car nation. And it's, if you come to Los Angeles and don't have a car, you can't really experience the city because we don't have a subway, either that is built with any sort of precision we have one that runs from downtown into the valley on the other side of town, but we have a big circular, town. So you have to have a car to see yourself around this place. But what I like about Los Angeles is they're the most enlightened, awesome, artistic, awake, humble, cool people. And there's also the worst, evil, horrible, self-centered, absolutely the worst people in the world are also in Los Angeles. And the whole trick to living here is trying to have a good judge of character and surround yourself with the positive artists and humble human beings that come here to make the art that we love, and minus the people that are here to vampire off of the rest of us.
Mm-hmm. That's such a great description. I was just enjoying listening to it. Because am I right in saying, because obviously, just to let people know who are listening, we're here is going to talk to Manu about his late... Ooh, we got an internet connection. Can you hear me okay?
What I was saying is you can easily get lost in the decadence and the wearing the coolest clothing and being on the coolest show and the ego that is LA and what Hollywood and LA sells. And, so it's sort of a trick to stay conscious here. You have to really, visiting is fun because you can just go and see a bunch of the historical sites and, see the beach and hang out and have a good time. But living here is a constant battle with your own, ego and your own sense of self to try to not sell out to the political to the propaganda machine.
Thank you for finishing that train of thought so I can put that together. Some reason my video is not working, so do you want me to try and get that back or should we just keep going?
It's okay as long as we've got the sound.
Yeah, it's still, I mean, I would be recording the entire time, so that's not a problem. So the train of thought I was heading to was to say to the people who are listening, obviously we're here to talk to Manu about his latest project, which is on Kickstarter, called The Circuit, which I'm excited to talk to him about. But I wanted to kind of like, because I always enjoy, you know, with having somebody on that's been on a, you know, very, very well-known show, as I say, I've got a tattoo of it, so that tells you all you need to know. Is I'm kind of interested, I obviously know a little bit about you and I obviously do a bit of research when people come on, but I wanted to ask, so when did sort of the idea of acting for you come into play in your life? Was it something you always wanted to do?
Definitely. I can pinpoint it back to, it even says it in my bio on IMDb, but I can pinpoint it back to, I was either 3 or 4 years old and I was in McCall, Idaho, and I was watching for the first time a play. Mm-hmm. And I was watching community theater production of Peter Pan. And I remember the moment when the actors started having their happy thoughts and they were on wires, mm-hmm. and they started flying around the stage, being mesmerized by the magic of theater and wanting to be a part of it in some way, shape, or form. And from that point, you know, I moved around a lot as a kid. My parents were hippies, so they were in different communes and rainbow gatherings and, you know, love campgrounds and, just traveling in their VW bus. All the cliche things that you can possibly, we were growing sprouts, we were eating tofu, we were wearing tie-dye, we were praying for peace and love wherever we went, listening to the Beatles. Well, at that time it was more like Madonna and Michael Jackson and all that stuff in the '80s, but, you know, I just completely just lost my train of thought because I went into Hippieville.
That's totally fine. We were just talking about like how your acting came to be. You were watching Peter Pan.
When we moved, I would beg my parents to get me involved in community theater productions. And I did that for a long time. And I would beg them to move to L.A., but they weren't city folk. They didn't like living in a big city at all. Mm-hmm. And so when I was 17, I decided to move out here. I was doing a play called Marvin's Room, and there was I was in San Luis Obispo, California, which is like 300 miles north of LA, and that's where I finished up high school. And there was a manager in the audience who saw my performance in the play and said, "What are you doing after high school?" And I said, "I'd like to go to school. I'd like to get involved in filmmaking." And she said, "Well, if you move to Los Angeles, I'll get you an agent. I'll represent you." And off I went. And that's
bro.
Been the story ever since, the last 20 years.
I remember talking to this about with Claudia Christian from Babylon 5. And it was really nice to talk to her about, because she had a very, like, it almost sounds like a similar situation to you, in that she just decided acting's what I wanted to do, and she moved to LA really relatively young and started quite young. And I always like asking this because I guess when you become an actor and people watch a bunch of stuff, is that they think, oh, it's like ingrained in you, or you've got like unbelievable support. But that's never, you know, it's always interesting to ask why that is the case instead of assuming. So what was your you sort of touched on it. What was your parents' reaction to you wanting to pursue like an acting career? How did they take it?
Well, they were artists in the sense that they were painters, and they certainly enjoyed art. I think my dad was probably like, "Oh, great, you know, I'm going to have to support him the rest of his life."
that's what my parents think. Yeah,
yeah, but it is ingrained in you in a sense. I've known from a very young age that doctor, lawyer, dentist, none of that stuff was going to make me happy. And yeah. I was interested in all of it. I've always also had a gigantic feeling that our species has a lack of empathy. And what movies do for me, especially great movies, is if I go in and I see a film and it happens to be about somebody outside of what I can relate to, But I still, through the story, get a sense of empathy for that particular human being or that set of human beings that the movie's about. And I walk out feeling more connected to my fellow man. That's what I think the best movies do, is they make you relate to people outside of your own sense of who you are and what's important.
I couldn't agree more with you in terms of the empathy, what you said about empathy. I do think in general, that's something, because one of the things I was telling Manu before we started about, that I am doing some more, like, I'm doing more freelance and stuff, which is keeping me in Newcastle, because he was asking me if I was going to start Destination Star Trek. And one of the things I'm wanting to do is lecturing, because of sort of stuff like you just said about having empathy, more empathy for people, and it's something I talk about, you know, in blogs and various things all the time. So I totally agree with you. I think that's one of the beautiful things about doing art form stuff, is that it leads you to realize like a story from another person's point of view.
And that's hard to do. I think I knew from a very young age, this has dawned on me as I've gotten older and wiser, but that the reason that I act is I never wanted to be a police officer or be a fireman, but I would like to be for a couple months to show people what it's like. And I was, so acting was a way for me to get my message across, hopefully, if I can get the right parts and produce the right stuff. To remind ourselves that we're not all islands, and that we're not all alone, that we're, there's this sort of, you know, I think human beings, especially in our culture, right, we've got a capitalist culture, and so it's all, we're all taught to try to get more money than the other guy, get a better truck than the other guy, get a better house, root for your city, root for your city against that city in basketball, football. It's all competition and individualism. And you can easily lose sight of, you know, that guy across the street that's hungry is just another form of you.
Yeah.
It's the only way I know how to try to raise the level of empathy for your fellow man and woman.
I get what you mean. As you were saying that, you reminded me of, I saw a bunch of interviews with Hugh Laurie did for about House, and he said that his dad was a doctor, or at least was involved in the medical profession, I seem to remember. And he said exactly the same thing, like you said about, I didn't feel I had the brains or the know-how to want to be a doctor, but the thing that House gives me the opportunity to do is to show how hard and difficult them type of decisions are for a person to do on a daily basis. And I really understood that. I mean, I'm not even claiming to be an actor. I mean, I've done some improvised comedy before, but But yeah, so I guess as someone who doesn't do them kind of things, I guess from a fan's point of view, I really understand
what
you think in that
performance. That is too right. You've got a narcissistic,
yeah,
drug addicted doctor,
yes,
that doesn't really give a crap about anybody. He's interested in just what the disease is and how he can fight it. But you absolutely love him.
Yeah, because it's the whole thing about it's almost sexy for someone to be a guy who heals people. That almost like trumps every bad thing he has. Like,
yeah,
I agree with you completely. I love that show.
Every single one of us have our little idiosyncrasies or our problems, and we have to learn to love each other. And if we don't, at some point, stop with the hate or the judgmental, I'm better than this person or that person or this country or that person or skin color or whatever that we're stuck in, that really we haven't, you know, we just started to, what, 1950, right? We've just started to really take the idea that we're equal.
Yeah.
It's just happened. I mean, throughout all of history, it was basically accepted that we weren't. So I don't ever give us a real hard time. We just started the equal rights movement less than a century ago. So, you know, we're getting there. And I think acting and art and all that stuff, filmmaking, is a way to keep that message going.
No, I couldn't agree with you more. Well, one of the things, because we were talking about, you know, when you first started, and so you said you moved to LA at 17.
Yes.
So the obvious question to ask in relation to that, because I remember when Claudia Christian said that, my first response was like, not are you mad, but it was, are you, I'm saying it in a much nicer way when I say, did you have any sort of trepidation?
Batshit crazy.
Which you can say, yeah. Enjoy saying it, Manu. Go ahead.
I've accepted my crazy. I'm totally nuts. I'm bonkers.
Oh.
And at the time, it was a crazy decision, and I love it. I hate normal people.
Yeah, but I totally agree. I think, do you find, like, I'll ask you directly, do you find when the word normal to be, you know, very dull?
Oh, it's a horrible word.
Yeah.
And I don't hate them. I don't like to even use that word hate. I feel for normal people. It seems to be so exhausting to have to fight, you know, fill in all the social norms and put my napkin in right and don't do this, don't do that, don't do this. You know, they seem to be so, you know, being caught up in all that. I could never be a decadent, aristocratic, stuff. I can't do it. It makes me sick.
I usually don't do this, Manu, but it's just intriguing me, right? Is that it's almost like we know we're doing well doing a podcast because we can hear laughter in the background. We've got our own little audience. so just because it's fun, I've never usually do this, but should we acknowledge who is in the room with you?
Sure. Back there is my roommate and good friend, Valerie, who's eating something.
Hello. Was she the person from before? Is that a different person?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
You look different from that angle. But yes. Anyway, it's just nice because she can be like the way we can acknowledge if we're saying something funny because we can hear it. It was really fun. Usually, when I first started doing this, Manu, the thing that always used to interrupt podcasts, because I used to go and, like, I guess, interview people from, like, the local comedy circuit when I first started and all this kind of thing, the regular interruption would be a cat of some description, just walking in or on the microphone. And so, yeah, it's nice to be a human being for once. But, yeah.
Yeah, much more interesting than a dog.
Indeed, yeah. So, I obviously was just being sort of semi-serious when I asked that question, but the serious point is, did you have any, because it seems obvious when you watch, like, Inside the Actor's Studio, they always ask this kind of thing, is it must be really, you must have a lot of courage to decide to do a profession where, you know, I don't know, you probably got a better percentage than me, but something like 95% of actors probably struggle most of their career and may not get to do the profession that they're trying to do, and it doesn't have a high success rate, I guess. So
no, the worst. I think the probably the second worst thing you could choose to do with your life as far as economical,
12 years.
Poet. I think,
did I hear 12 years in the background there? Is that how long you usually get? I heard 12 years, I think, but.
She's an aspiring actress. She's like 12 years wasted.
Hello and welcome to Therapy Hour with my with your host, yeah. Stephen.
I think.
So, no, I was just asking, did you have any. It's obviously very courageous to be an actor and wanting to do it. So, did you have any real. Because I guess to explain my point is. You have to have, I'm assuming, a very huge amount of willpower. As someone who started a small business, that's the same, I guess it has the same sort of courageousness. Is that? But also, I think a lot of people assume, especially fans, is that it's like it's an easy decision or you don't have any trepidations about doing it. So I'm just intrigued what it was like for you. Did you feel confident it was going to work out or...
I'm confident in my skill set. I knew I had skills. I knew I had the ability to do it at a very young age. But I live in constant fear and self-doubt all the time. That is what acting, good acting is. Good acting is being able to, you know, if you're going to play a scene, and you're going to play a scene in which, for instance, just to for the sake of coming up with something, there's maybe your sick father is dying in your arms. Mm-hmm. To actually play that scene correctly, there's a couple actors in the world that can fake it and the camera doesn't realize that they're not actually going there mentally, that they're not actually convincing themselves that that is their father, that he is dying, that this is all happening. But I think the best actors go there. Mm-hmm. And what takes courage is forcing yourself to have that experience for a live audience.
Yeah.
And it hurts. It's painful. And as far as the courage otherwise, like just whether the profession's going to work out for me or not, mm-hmm. I personally don't really have a choice in the matter.
Yeah.
I don't find happiness anywhere else but when those cameras are on. Mm. And I'm on a set and we're trying to capture moments of truth. We're trying to capture whatever it is we're trying to get to entertain, inspire others, whether we're going to make them laugh, cry, scream, feel connected, feel terrified, whatever movie we're making.
Yeah.
That's the only time I can truly say I feel happy.
Yeah.
I feel like myself. I feel like I'm doing what I'm supposed to be doing in this life. So it's not really courageousness. It's more... I've tried the other thing, and the other thing makes me miserable. So So it's ride or die. It's do this until it works or it doesn't.
Yeah.
And in between, whether you're an A-list super success and you get to be a Jack Nicholson for 10 years, or you just get to do a bunch of little parts throughout your life, all those moments are worth it. When those cameras turn on. I did a terrible movie last year. I did this really terrible, horrible film. But the part was great. And
yes. And
the film was just a tragic, horrible time. And it came out just horrible. But the moments of making it were completely worthwhile. Everybody was on the project were wonderful human beings. They were trying their best to execute a beautiful story. But we didn't pull it off. I did. I was freaking excellent.
Yeah, you just cut that part out, Manu, and send that to agencies. That'll be fine.
Yeah, and you know, my co-star was excellent, and we got to have this amazing human experience throughout the project, and no one will ever get to see it. But it doesn't matter. It's about going there and. For all the people that made that movie, we all had a great time doing it.
Yeah.
The bonus is when you make a great film and you go get to see it affect other people. But all of it's great. So.
Yeah, yeah. Because I was going to ask you, because as you were saying that, you made me sort of think about whenever anybody asks me, I've done the occasional interview where people have asked me about podcasting and the experience of doing that and interviewing people. And And I say to people in regards to, like you said about, you have to do it. It's like almost like you're made to do it because it makes you happy. It's one of the reasons why I totally do this, is that I have never felt, I totally understood what you said, because I've tried various different things. I gigged and I've did comedy for a bit at university, and I've been a youth worker. I've done a various bunch of things, but the consistent thread is I get more enjoyment from just sitting down, getting to know somebody. Like, it's almost like an endorphin buzz that I can't replicate. And so,
yeah.
That's why I often get asked when I've met people like yourself who, you know, you're in a show, which I'm sure we'll get to, because I'm trying to not geek out about the fact I'm talking to a person from Voyager. But, but in all seriousness, that everyone sometimes asks me, you know, do you get nervous talking to people? I'm like, it doesn't necessarily matter if it's you, or we've had other people local from around here, or I've had my mom on here for one episode for a special reason. Is I just love communicating with people. So I wanted to ask you, because I resonated with that, is that kind of part of the experience as well when you do films, is that you get to, you know, because a lot of the times you're on a film, if you're part of like the main cast, you can be on it for 3, 4, 5, 6, maybe 9 months even. So is the experience also the fact that you get to, you know, get to know people like the production crew and everything else in your cast as well? Is that part of the reason you enjoy doing it?
Yeah, it's a gigantic human connection. Film is all of the great arts in one. There's not an art out there that you can name that isn't involved in film. Mm-hmm. Music, painting, art, sculpture, sound design, architecture, mm-hmm. poetry, name them, writing. It's all mixed into one. And so you get this group of people. Imagine, I always say this, but imagine taking like the great painters, the top 20 great painters of their time, and giving them one canvas and saying, go ahead, guys, make a masterpiece. Good luck, right?
I know what you mean, yeah.
So, you know, it's this impossible attempt that you're making every time over and over again, mm-hmm. with dedicated artists that are all trying to be the best at their craft. And you're trying to team up and make one film out of all of your talents. And it's great meeting all of those people. And, mm-hmm. you know, and I've always loved movies since I was a young, young person. I was transfixed by films. And so occasionally you get these brilliant 2 days. I mean, I worked for 48 hours with Leonardo DiCaprio and Clint Eastwood on this project called Jay Edgar.
You know what it is? I read your IMDb a couple of days ago just to freshen up on other stuff you've done, and I was like, I totally remember you being in that. I absolutely adored that film.
But just like the film I was talking about earlier, mm-hmm. I worked with Leo. We shot a really long scene. We had some great stuff. It was amazing getting directed by Clint Eastwood.
I know, yeah.
For 2 days.
I don't know. I don't know why I just said that, Manu. I know. I clearly don't know, but
well, you can imagine. Yeah. He was a wonderful. He was awesome. Mm-hmm. And you know, I was so. This was a time. I'm very not starstruck anymore. But going to work on that job, I had a little bit of nervous energy in me because I was like, Mr. Eastwood? Do I call him Clint? Is he going to yell at me if I don't say sir?
Do I call him sir? Yeah, yeah. That's what I was thinking, yeah.
So I'm standing there and we're about to shoot and he's across the way sitting there next to Brian Grazer, who I also love, that producer with the huge spiky hair that's made an amazing film.
Yeah, yeah.
So Clint gets up and I'm standing there on set and he starts walking towards me really slow and he's staring me down like, here comes Clint. And I don't know if he's coming at me or not, but it looks like it. And he saunters all the way over to me and he gets to me, he looks me right in the eye. And he pauses and he's just daggering me. And I'm like, well, what am I going to do here? And he goes, well, if it isn't Manu, blah, blah, blah. And then he elbowed me and he winked at me. And I immediately went, oh, man, this is Uncle Clint. I don't have anything to worry about. This guy's hilarious. And he was giving me crap the whole day and just kind of winking at me like, hey, got you again. And so he immediately put me on his level. And and so did Leo. Leo came up to me and was like, "Hey man, what's up? I'm Leo. Let's knock this out. Let's do some work. Let's have some fun." And it was no pretension, no nonsense. And two great days in my life. Did a lot of this, almost everything that we shot didn't make the film. Mm-hmm. I was part of four criminals that had scenes in the film. They decided to cut all that stuff. So I had one line in the movie in the end, but it wasn't about that. It was about getting to work with people that I always loved their work.
Your own memories, yeah.
Yeah, and getting to see if I had the skills to hang with these guys. Could I work with these guys? And I found out that I did. And I also found out that these guys that I look up to aren't a-holes, which is all also fantastic when you find out that some of your heroes are cool.
Just in case, I always like doing this joke. He meant arsehole for those that are interested.
Yes. Yes, I did.
Which I can say as an English person, it's arsehole.
Yeah. Every once in a while, you know, your heroes are assholes, and you're like, man, that sucks.
Well, I wanted to ask you, because it's always interesting, this element of being starstruck, because when you actually said about Clint Eastwood, I've always been sort of fascinated to know. Because I'm, even though, as I say, I'm not an actor, I'm not being in anything, you know, remotely special or anything like that, but I'm really intrigued to know the sort of behind-the-scenes process. I'm always somebody who, like, for example, will listen to the audio commentaries on DVDs and stuff like that. I always like hearing how stuff's made. And so I'm just intrigued for my own, curiosity is, how does Clint direct people? What's his usual process?
One of the best, the best director I've ever worked for, hands down, because he's not tied to anything. Mm-hmm. He's not tied to the script. He's not tied. He doesn't have, I think he has an idea of what he wants to get, but he's not interested in the ego, in the controlling the art. Mm-hmm. And there's so many people that get wrapped up in, I have a vision and this is what I want to make, but they forget that they've got 50 artists around them. Mm-hmm. The guys doing the lights, those guys are artists. The extras, the way that they perform, that's art. Clint came up to me and Leo, and I remember him pulling out the script. And in the scene, we were going down these steps, me and my posse. I was one of my bad gangster friends, and this hot girl, and we're getting into our car. And Leo and the FBI, he's playing J. Edgar, they're coming up the street, sneaking up on us. And so Clint comes over and he's got the script and he's looking at me and he's looking at Leo and he goes, "Hey, Manu, what are you doing down there? What is that?"
"I'm sorry, it's the new trailer for Pirates of the Caribbean.
You can't be watching trailers while we're doing a podcast."
"Come on, Matt." "Oh, we've reached the point where we've bored the person, our one audience member." "Oh no." As in our one live audience member. I hope people are still with us listening. So.
I completely just lost my train of thought too.
I asked you about Clint Eastwood directing, and you were saying about.
So he's got the script, and he's going, "Okay, Monty, you go down the stairs, and you're coming out, you're Alvin Karpis, and you open the door and say whatever you want to say, and then you come down, and Leo, you're coming down the street, Leo, when you come upon the car. Crap, break the window open and say," and he pointed to the line in the script and went, "whatever comes to you, whatever you want to say. And then, when you're coming out of the car, say something. And then, Leo, you say something, whatever you feel like. And then, we'll take a look at that, see how it goes." So he was very, like, the script had lines. The script had directions. We were going to follow them, but he was very much like, "Everybody stay open to what's happening in the moment. Mm-hmm. Don't forget that I don't have any rules. If something happens, I want to see it. He was very like, "Don't stop yourself. Let's run this a couple times. Let's see how it works off of the page." And so then I immediately knew, wow, I can improv. I can be loose. I don't have to be tied to every specific word. So I started throwing things at Leo. He started throwing things back. The scene developed and became a little bit more than it was on the page, even though we had a phenomenal writer. The script was great. Mm-hmm. But then then Clint would wander back in after the scene progressively died. He would take a long time to call cut, which was also kind of cool. I think a lot of directors call cut and then they miss a lot of things that could have happened. Then he comes back in and he goes, stares us both down, thinks about it for a while, mm-hmm. same, like, takes his time. Yep. He goes, yeah, that was good, let's shoot that. And then he would announce to everyone else on the set, anyone else got any ideas? Literally, whether you were a grip, a gaffer, an extra, he would hear you out if you had something to say to him.
Wow.
So he was so open to input mm-hmm. on how to make the movie better. And I remember telling him, yeah, I've got an idea. Why don't you put two guys right outside the door with shotguns so I don't even have a chance to get to the car, and they just rack the shotguns and you've got me, and there's no, you know, there's no suspense. Like, that's how the FBI probably would do it. They wouldn't let me get to the car. And he thought about it for a second, and he goes, yeah, but then we wouldn't have a scene. but it was, you know, it was great. He even took the time to listen, you know, and if I had a better idea, he would have taken it. And I think that's good directing, is not being tied to controlling the environment.
Without, like, sort of naming particular shows you've been on in the past, because I was going to talk to you a little bit before we get to Voyager for a little bit, is the stuff you did before. You did, like a lot of guest appearances on, you know, one-episode deals, I think, from what I read in the IMDb. And what's that like, sort of going to, you know, in some cases, established shows and just going for one episode? Is that kind of weird? Do you feel like the sort of the stranger in a field of people, or what's it feel like?
It always depends on the actors and the people on that show. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you feel like everybody welcomes you as family and you've got the job and they respect that and they bring you right in. It depends on who the stars of the show are. I've come on to shows where I felt like I was a part of the show from the get-go, even though I was only there for 2 weeks.
Yeah.
I've also come on to shows where I felt like I was complete, you're just the weekly guy. I'm not even going to hang around and be on the other side of camera for you because I'm the star and you're not the star, and so don't even talk to me. And, you know, I had a couple people on a show I worked on, like, they wouldn't even run lines or talk to me during rehearsals.
Wow.
And it was like, wow, like, and Voyager was really cool because I came onto that show and literally every cast member on that show was welcoming. It felt like I was joining a family, and I didn't feel weird about coming on to any of them. I was certainly nervous about trying to stay on the show and do good work, but they were all there to help me do that. Mm-hmm. And I've stayed friends. In fact, the project I'm working on now, I stayed friends with Tim, Russ, and Picardo, and Ethan is on the project. Robert Beltran's on the project. I'm going to beg Kate Mulgrew to join us at some point. I know how busy she is. But I feel a connection to everybody in that cast. And, mm-hmm. and I also feel a connection. The cool thing about Star Trek is you then get to join the convention circuit scene afterwards.
Yeah.
And I've also met a ton of people from all the other casts, and I'm really close with Armin Shimerman, and so I brought him onto my last film, Fifth Passenger, and now The Circuit. And I've met people from every cast and sort of become a part of a gigantic Star Trek family, or sci-fi family. And then the convention circuit has blown up to include all of these genre shows now, and you know, I've been in such surreal moments where I'm sitting next to, like, Harry Potter's on my left and Knight Rider's on my right, Princess Leia's across the table, and we're eating dinner in Germany, and I have to realize that we're not the characters that I'm looking at, that I'm Manu and you know, he's David. Mm-hmm. Surreal, fun moments that I've been nothing but, you know, thankful for.
And I mean, as someone who's speaking purely as a fan, you can imagine, I mean, if you experience that, being that you're part of a well-established franchise, can you imagine what a fan of sci-fi feels like, walking in and seeing yourself and you know, Carrie Fisher, as you mentioned, and you know, I love the fact that conventions have become, because it used to be, I mean, we always talk about it on this podcast, because we sometimes do hosted episodes where me and a couple of co-hosts get together, and we always talk about the convention scene and how much it sort of grew over time, because in the last, I don't know, would you say 25 years, maybe, it's just completely grown from, a sort of niche thing where you may get one major star from one show turning up. Like, I remember hearing a story about Patrick Stewart once went and convinced the Next Generation stars to go, and he was like the catalyst for them being involved in conventions. But as you say, it's now reached a point where, you know, even conventions in England, which took a bit of time to get going, it's now reached a point where there's so many different people from so many franchises, and it's just, it's really cool, isn't it, to be a fan? Because I'm assuming that you're a fan of stuff yourself.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that's what's been so neat, is when I started 15 years ago with Voyager, it was very much science fiction convention, or it was Star Trek conventions. And it wasn't Comic-Con yet. It wasn't, all these other people hadn't joined the party. And over the last, I think, 10 years, 12 years is when it's actually really become this multi-genre thing. And so, you know, I've gotten to meet and become good friends with a bunch of people from a bunch of different shows that I've loved or been a fan of, and gotten to meet the human connection behind it. And that most people, too, that I've met from the genre type shows, most of them are pretty cool people.
Yeah.
And there's a few a-holes, but most of them considering, like, if you, like I said, when you're a guest star and you come on to TV stars in general, tend to be a little bit cynical and full of themselves compared to when you meet movie stars, they tend to be a little bit more humble. Just the general rule, this isn't true about everybody.
Yeah.
But, and what's weird is I've been on a bunch of different shows where I'm like, wow, everybody here is kind of full of themselves. But on the convention, the genre scene, I think people, I don't know why, but aren't. I don't have an answer for why people are maybe because they're willing to play these type of completely crazy makeup covered characters, like Doug Jones, for instance. He came onto my project recently and he did Fifth Passenger with me. And there's a guy that's like, you know, held up 10 eyes with his hands and been the Monsters and Silver Surfer and Abe Sapien. And, one of the kindest, maybe the most gentle, loving souls I've met on planet Earth. That's always awesome to me when people don't have their egos tweaked by the success they've had. Carl Urban, really cool guy.
Yeah.
It's neat to meet the new cast and get to meet some of those guys. Bumped into Carl 3 or 4 times over the last year, and just a down-to-earth, good human being.
Because obviously, you know, speaking of Voyager, so I guess let's get... We've done very well to talk for however long without talking to it in detail, and I feel like I should pat myself on the back for avoiding it this long. So in terms of Voyager, when you first, I'm assuming you've answered this maybe more often than you'd like to, but I'm intrigued by the audition process and when that opportunity came up. How did that happen?
I just got a call from my agent saying, you know, you've got an audition for Star Trek. You're auditioning for this character called First. I was auditioning for the bad guy in the episode. And I auditioned for it 3 or 4 times, and then I didn't get the role, and I was all bummed out, and they called me and said, well, we're not going to give you the role of First, the bad guy part that you read for, but we're going to give you the more sensitive role, the second. So I was, you know, I was all, like, butthurt about being a man. I wanted to play the big bad guy, and I have to play the sensitive guy instead. But then, you know, little do you know what the universe has planned for you. He became Icheb, and then I had 2 seasons of the show, and that other character died in that episode.
You got the look of the deal there.
You know, there was also this crazy thing that happened that I found out a couple years later from my agent at the time. First thing I ever did in this town was a movie called Senseless, and Ron Cerma cast it, and it was a movie about Marlon Wayans getting super senses when he took this drug at this college. And it's a slapstick comedy with David Spade and Matthew Lillard. And Ron cast me in it as a small part. We were doing a thing. The scene was a play on the Pulp Fiction scene where with the needle, and it was just a spoof of that.
Yeah.
And I was really bad in it. And it got back to Ron that I was really bad. I shot 35 takes. The director yelled at me. Marlon and Matthew Lillard and Marlon Wayans were trying to help me through the scene, and I was nervous, and I thought about quitting acting.
Wow.
2 years later, Ron and my agent are sitting there, and in a long story short, they were in a pedicure place, and my agent tried to pitch Ron that I could do the role, and Ron was like, "No, that actor's terrible. I got a horrible report card on him. Not a chance." And my agent yelled at him and got mad, and the lady cut his foot, and it was bleeding. And so he said, I'm bleeding for my freaking client, and you made me bleed because I know how good my client is, and he's not like he was those 2 years ago, so you're going to freaking see him, damn it. And Ron was like, okay, I'll read him. And, you know, long story short, I got the part.
But, nice.
That's kind of a funny
yeah.
thing that I learned a couple years later, too. Mm-hmm. What's also been weird about Icheb and how I got the role and how the role lasted as long as it did, I don't know the answer to the questions mm-hmm. because they hired me per episode for those last 2 years, and every time that they gave me an Icheb storyline that was a story or the episode was based around him in some way, he would almost die.
Mm-hmm.
So I never knew whether they were going to write me off, whether the plan was to keep me like they did all the way to the end and bring me back to Earth, or whether I would be gone the next week.
Yeah.
So it was, I really don't know. It just how the part evolved, whether they had the plan for him, whether they were making it up as they went.
Mm-hmm.
I think a little bit of both.
Yeah, I usually find, I mean, even just reading about stuff like that, or people I've talked to who have been in long-running series, is that, I mean, I guess it's like the classic, I guess, the series that everyone points to. Is like, I remember the writers of Lost saying that they ironically didn't really know where they were going with it, and they were sort of writing it as they go, and some people were like, really? You can't, you don't really know 100% where you're going. And I kind of think if you do enough research on certain series, you find quite a lot of people, or they have maybe an idea of where to take it, but in terms of each individual character, they might not be sure. And I guess with Voyager, I remember thinking that they said this at the time, that there was quite a lot of main cast members for the show. So to get them all to be, you know, get an episode a bit, you know, around them, and you were kind of like, I would say, would it be fair to say like the recurring cast or the second tier out of the main people? So it must be difficult for them to get, you know, scenes for everybody and give everyone enough to do. Because I often hear, especially with Star Trek, some people get very some cast members wishing they had more time to do things and all that kind of stuff. But I wanted to ask you about so in terms of you didn't send me a message there. I thought you were sending a message to me because it was like, no, it's okay.
Sorry, I spaced out something. I had to take care of.
Totally fine. I was just saying, was it weird for you being Icheb? Is that, I imagine it's like a lot of people in Voyager were sort of unsure where the character was going, and I guess, you know, it must have been hard having a big cast like in Voyager where they dedicated some episodes to. Did you find that while you were working on it?
Whether they were planning on, whether they had the plan for Icheb set in stone or whether they were making it up as they went, I think it was a little bit of both. I knew that Icheb was going to be around when we did I thought the writing for him and the kids, when they got back to the ship, it seemed like the writers didn't know what to do with us.
Mm-hmm.
Because the first few episodes, it would just be like, the kids are building something, or the kids are doing something, and Seven's looking after them, and Icheb doesn't want to do it, and he's a brat, and that's that. Mm-hmm. And I sort of thought, oh man, I'm just going to kind of play this bratty kid, and we're never going to really go anywhere with this. And then they decided to send those other kids home and give me an episode, and I think it was sort of a test episode. In my head, it was a test episode to see whether my character was interesting enough to carry an episode, whether I was a decent enough actor at 21 to carry an episode.
Mm-hmm.
And that episode was called Child's Play, where I went to see my parents, and my evil parents send me back to the Borg again.
Oh, yeah. Great episode, yeah.
Yeah, and I remember Brandon Braga, one of the showrunners, a talented writer, producer, coming mm-hmm. down to set, and shaking my hand and saying, hey, you're doing good work on this show. Congratulations. And he didn't say for what, but it was sort of like a little silent nod that you're going to be around for a while, so don't fuck up.
It's a nice way of saying it, yeah.
Yeah.
That's really cool. I mean, like, just because I'm intrigued, when the original, the episode where they meet the three kids, the episode where you first get introduced, was the plan all along to have them survive and end up on Voyager?
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. That's the sort of big mystery that I've always wondered. You know, mm-hmm. I asked Brian Fuller at the time because he was working on the show and he's doing the new show now. Like, who created my character? I know Jerry Taylor created him.
All right.
But then what they were planning on, I think with 26 episodes a year, I think you have a rough idea of where you're opening the season and where you're closing the season. And yeah. I think from that point on, you're kind of winging it.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, I think they found out that I could act and they found out a great story. They had this great character that they came up with. The idea that they came up with was fantastic. And mm-hmm. so they were able to run with that. This kid that was born to kill Borg with the virus in his bloodstream
mm-hmm.
that was sent back to the Borg a second time and then also was like this boy genius. And then they told the story that worked so well for them before with Seven of Nine
mm-hmm.
and with Hugh Borg of a Borg that's been Borgified, for lack of a better word. And has to find his humanity or find his identity. Yeah. And so, you know, they did that with Seven and the Captain, and then they were able to do that with Seven and me. And it was all really interesting, fun, great writing as soon as the other kids took off. And
mm-hmm.
it's not their fault that the writing didn't get good till then. I really loved those kids, and it was sad to see them go.
Yeah.
But I don't think they could have written as well for six children. Naomi Wildman was also on the ship, so
yeah.
It would have been really hard to have good writing for six kids.
Well, that's what I was saying before, is that like they already had a pretty big cast in Voyager, and some of the main cast members were not getting, you know, an episode dedicated to them. So I imagine all the sort of bit-bot people that were coming for guest appearances or recurring cast must be difficult to get them to do like a story arc involving them. Because you got a lot of mouths to feed in terms of creativity, so I understood it when I was watching it. I was like, yeah, it is kind of reaching a point where they were doing a fair amount with your character, but for the other two, it was seemed difficult. But I wanted to ask you, because I have, as I touched on at the beginning of the show, I have met a couple of other Voyager cast members, and I always like asking, I guess because I'm a Star Trek fan, and I think people who are Star Trek fans listening to this will probably want me to ask. Is you often hear the comparisons between Star Trek series in terms of behind the scenes and how it was, what it was like to work on it and all this kind of thing. So what was it like for you in the weeks, I guess, because I imagine it would be, you know, as you said, two seasons is quite a decent amount of time. So
that was 2 years.
Yeah. So what was it like from your experience working on it? Were the crew, you know, got on with each other? Did you enjoy the experience, like when the cameras went rolling and all this kind of stuff, and the takes in between? What was it like?
A pure, super balls crazy awesomeness. It was 2 years of waking up at 4:45 in the morning to go work on a spaceship all day long
mm-hmm.
and make believe with incredible actors, writers. And I was getting beamed up and beamed down, for God's sake. What could possibly suck about that? I loved it. I loved the cast. The cast loved each other. All this stuff about Jerry and Kate having beef has all been blown up in the media way bigger than I ever saw it. Mm-hmm. I was 21 years old. I think maybe they had some tension in the beginning. I think there's some reality to that. But at least the last couple seasons, I worked with those two a lot. A lot of my scenes were with them, and I felt like they respected each other. They had fun with each other. I think they put that thing to sleep really quick, and the media woke it back up mm-hmm. recently. I don't think there was as much to it as people make out.
Yeah.
And everybody on that set got along and had fun. And the boys, when they were on set, we messed around and tried to make each other laugh, and we were total goof-offs. And then when Kate showed up, we would immediately snap to attention and start again. Only because she demanded respect, and not because she was scary, but because she was just damn good. And she was a professional and a phenomenal actor. And when she came on set, we were reminded that we needed to put on our A-game. So she very much was our captain in a way.
Yeah, I just wanted to say, because I'm glad you... I wasn't going to bring this up, but I'm... One of the things I told Manu before we started about why I do podcasting, and I'm never somebody who goes down the route of saying the topical, what's the controversial question I can ask? Because I obviously, being a Star Trek fan, have read the whole thing about Jerry and Kate Mulgrew. So I'm pleased you acknowledged it, but I just wanted to reiterate to people that I'm not going to delve into that anymore because I'm bored of it.
Boring, and I think they put it to bed 15 years ago.
Yeah, exactly.
A lot of people wanted to bring that back up, and I think both of them were like, what a pain in the butt. We got over this a long time ago. What are you guys going to talk about?
Yeah, it's making, I guess it's just when you're in the world of like any sort of news that they can grasp hold of can make some sort of stuff, they just put it out there and not worry about the consequence. I think that's kind of the situation. I wanted to ask you because I saw a talk with Robert Picardo at a convention where I've met Robert Picardo briefly, and he talked very openly because obviously the Doctor and Seven of Nine's relationship grew over the series, so he had a lot of scenes with her, and obviously you and her and Echip had a lot of scenes with her, and I just wanted to ask you in a positive sense what it was like working with Jerry, because I actually think for the character that she started with to when it ended, I always say this about Robert Picardo, I think he's phenomenal, I just wanted you to talk about the growth of their characters during the period of time they were on. Obviously, you know, Jerry was on a lot shorter than when people first started in terms of seasons, but like, so what was it like working and doing a lot of scenes with Jerry?
She was amazing. We got on really well. Off camera we joked, she laughed, it was always fun with her on set. It was never too serious. A lot of times she would bring her kid to set. The only thing that I knew that I couldn't do was flirt with her too much because she was dating Brandon at the time.
Yes.
Of course, I wanted to flirt with her because I was a 21-year-old man and she was about the hottest woman I'd seen up until that time. But she was also just fun. She was so fun that it was just a ball. I mean, I remember, you know, it was sort of, from an acting sense, she was my mother figure. But when the cameras turned off, it was just a couple of people at camp having a good time and we would crack each other up. And
sounds great.
Yeah, and she forced you to be a good actor. So did Rob Picardo. Working with Robert was always fun too, because he had so many little camera tricks and gimmicks and subtle things that he did with his eyes or his eyebrow. Or there's all the, you know, the Star Trek eyebrow is something that you pick up from other actors, and the subtle arcing of the eyebrow. But there's all those other little things, like, you know, Kate would always start with her eyes down, and then she would look up into the other actor's eyes, and I went, "Ooh, that's powerful!" And I would see the editors use that. So I was always stealing these seasoned actors' tricks when I was young. And,
yeah,
it was a learning time. It was a fun time, and Jerry and Robert were great, and Kate and everybody else as well. I got to work with the other guys as well. I got to work with every major cast member. Robert Beltran was the least. I only got to do one scene with him. Mm-hmm. But everybody on that show was a ton of fun. We did an episode called The Haunting of Deck 12 with Ethan Phillips as Neelix, and kids were there, and he was there. And I remember that just being a blast. Ethan Phillips is one of the funniest guys off camera that you'll ever meet. He's That's a neurotic cool. little weird guy.
Yeah.
With a ton of jokes to tell, and he's a blast. So It was just fun, man. Everybody was fun.
I can imagine, yeah. I mean, I often, if I ever like sort of fantasize about a series I'd like to be a part of, I have to say I would like to be on Voyager.
Plus, you're getting paid for it.
I know, yeah.
You're getting paid well for it on top of it. Like, it was like, that's crazy that can even happen to you in this lifetime.
It shows you're passionate about it, though, because you left the money to last when I asked you it. So that's kind of good. Yeah. You know, you didn't just start going because I got paid. I have actually... I'll not name, you know, people I've interviewed who have done this, but occasionally when I've asked questions like that, and that was a very, you know, interesting answer being a fan of the series, I have occasionally asked that question and got, because I was paid, next question. And I'm like, you know, it'd be nice to know you enjoy the process and you like the fact that, you know, people watched it and you people know who you are. You know, that's a bonus too. But I guess, you know, people do stuff for money, but it'd be nice on a talk show or podcast or something that you kind of elaborated and not just being that upfront.
I think sometimes when people are just in a bad mood, and sometimes you've done so many interviews and you're actors can be in bad moods too. I just give those guys a break because I bet you they're better people than you think they are.
That's why I always try when I interview people is to come up with questions that are interesting, that are different, because I hate the whole standard 10 questions that I'm sure you've been given a million times, so I try and give you something different.
For you to put your makeup on.
Yeah. Well, I did kind of want to ask you just because I'm a huge fan of the Borg. I think.
How long did it take you to put your makeup?
No, I'm not asking that. That would be funny though if I just went. Well, let's do the standard. Is if I had like notes in front of me. So, Manu, here you were on Star Trek Voyager, and I hear you were E-Chip. I hope I'm saying that correctly.
Yeah, I think so.
So the most question we got the most of is how long did it take you to put your makeup on? That question was from 10,000 Twitter people.
In dollar amount, I got paid for it. Next question.
Brilliant. That's awesome. Thank you. And I'll consider that question answered. In my notes. Okay, moving on.
You know what? I got to actually tell you, getting into the Borg makeup was pretty phenomenal experience. I've never gone through anything like it before. Mm-hmm. There's the whole casting that they have to do of you for the bodysuit, and that's crazy weird. And then you have to do a bald cap, and I had to put on pantyhose, and then over the pantyhose... They had to spray airbrush.
And then they said, Mano, we need you on set now.
Yeah. And then they put on the hard rubber stuff and then all the little technical gizmos that blinked and had lights attached. And when you walked around in the Borg makeup, you also had someone walk with you to make sure that nothing fell off your costume.
Yeah, yeah.
You had a person following you to the bathroom and following you to get bagels. And that was kind of odd. So you... And I was always in character because I wanted to play the role really right. So I always had this shadowy guy that was following me, and I don't remember much about them because I didn't talk to them because I was trying to stay in this robotic place. Yeah. And but then also the hair that they put on me, I had a bald cap, but then they would actually have me hold these two electrodes, and I don't know what this thing was called, but it would give my body an electrical charge. When they shot the hair, they would put some glue on top of my bald cap, and when they shot the hair out of it, the hair would stand, it would stick to the glue, and then stand up. And the electrical charge is what they made the hair stand up with. So it was all pretty amazing, this whole, process. So it took a long time.
Yes.
But it was
Thank you for finally answering my standard question. But honestly, a couple of quick questions about Star Trek, and then we'll move on, because I obviously, you know, it is the thing that I imagine people want to know the most about it. Is I wanted to just know, because I'm curious, because I always am, when I hear Star Trek people being interviewed, were you a fan before you got the part of the franchise?
Yeah, I was a fan of the franchise. I wasn't a fan of the shows. I didn't watch Next Gen, and I didn't watch Deep Space. Mm-hmm. I had seen a couple episodes of both. Mm-hmm. But I didn't follow them. But I was a huge fan of the films. I'd seen First Contact, I'd seen Generations, and I'd seen all the original series of films. Mm-hmm. So I definitely knew what I was getting into, and I was a fan of Star Trek, the film franchise.
Okay.
But getting to be a part of the show, the only episode that I can remember having seen before I got the part was the one where there's all those invisible aliens on the ship, and they're doing experiments on everybody, and
the captain had
a headache, and then when Seven could suddenly see them, she had all these.
Like, you're referring to the because there was a lot of episodes with people invading Voyager, like aliens and stuff. You're referring to the one where they're doing experiments and she puts them into like a, she puts Voyager into the sun, and Tuvok does that great line where he says, there's a 1 in 8 chance of surviving this, and that's what gets them to leave. Because she's getting headaches and stuff, and the doctor.
And then when you actually see what's happening to her, she had all these
stung
needles in her head.
Yeah.
And they were all getting messed with. It was very Twilight Zone-esque, and I remember seeing that. And those are my favorite episodes of all Star Trek. I love the self-contained episodes, the anthology type episodes, mm-hmm. where it's not the storyline that's being told throughout the season, but the self-contained stories that, mm-hmm. like Haunting of Deck 12, that it's one story, it happens at some space, time, and date, and then it's told and finished within that episode. Because mm-hmm. I'm a film fan. I like to see the beginning and end of the story, and I'm not such a fan of TV because I don't want to wait 48 episodes to see the end. I want to know.
I guess you got the advantage of like Netflix and stuff put all the episodes up at once now. I think it's sort of heading that direction, so that helps.
But I'm just a fan of. I wish there was more stuff like The Twilight Zone and Steven Spielberg's amazing stories. There's a new show called Black Mirror that I really enjoyed. Was a new show called Black Mirror that I wish they did more episodes of. It was a British show, I think, it was all self-contained episodes, and the only rule they followed was that it had to be sci-fi.
Okay.
So they were all very strange, wonderful stories with new actors. Black Mirror. If you haven't seen it, you should give it a look.
I have not. I am shocked to hear that it was British. I will definitely find it. All the good shows stop really quickly. It's really frustrating.
It's Netflix. It's called Black Mirror.
All right. I will have a look. Just in terms of when you said you were a fan of the Star Trek films, because I imagine I'll get yelled for not asking this. Like, what was your favorite one of the films, would you say, if you had to pick?
I think 4, just because I'm a hippie and the whales were cool. I like The Voyage Home. I also like First Contact, but that's not an original series film. Is that the question?
No, just the, out of any of the films you've seen, I didn't necessarily mean original series, just whatever you liked.
First Contact, and I liked Voyage Home. You gotta love the second one too.
Wrath of Khan. I always say that's my favorite of Push.
I mean, that's the one I remember the most from being a kid. That's the one that resonated the most. I remember the earbuds and seeing Khan appear the first time. And I was in the theater. I can remember the sensation of watching that thing, that earbud going to Chekhov. Good stuff.
Oh, yeah. Oh, God. Yeah, that used to give me sort of nightmares. I was born in, 87, so I saw them films way later than they came out. But that still used to really...
Back then, they still put them in the theaters, too. Like, I remember sitting in the theater watching it, and same with Star Wars. And I was born in 78. Star Wars came out in 78, but they would re-release them in the theaters, because I remember seeing Star Wars in the theaters, too.
Yeah, I saw the original Aliens, because I think they brought it out, like, sort of 20 years after it came out. So I love that film. So I went to see that in the film, in the pictures for the first time. But anyway, so... I wanted to ask, because this is always interesting, because I think this is maybe a misconception, but you can correct me if I'm wrong. So when Voyager obviously ended and you were involved in like 11 episodes, I think it was. The question I wanted to ask, because I'm intrigued to know what the answer is, does it open doors? Did it open doors for you in terms of, because I think that would be the assumption is that you're on a successful series that people liked and all that kind of stuff. As an actor, did that give you the credibility, I guess, is what I'm asking.
Yeah, those few years, I was young and I was sort of full of myself, and I kind of blew my chance at stardom, at least back then, because it did. I mean, I was seeing all the major casting directors in town at that point in time. I didn't really know, I didn't really understand. Like, I knew when I left Voyager, I remember the last day on set, like, looking around and going, wow, I've been a part of this thing, and it's coming to a conclusion, and what's next, and... I auditioned for Anakin, I auditioned for Spider-Man, for the lead in Spider-Man. I was auditioning for all the big stuff of the time. I auditioned for Legolas and Lord of the Rings. I was hanging with that crew. My friends were like Ben Foster and James Franco and Chris Evans and Aaron Paul, and like that was my running team. But they, unlike me, understood that they were only going to be looked at for the time for that period of time when they were hot. Mm-hmm. And I sort of half-assed a lot of auditions back then, and I was boozing it up a little too hard.
Yeah,
and so I it opened doors, but I never walked through them. Mm-hmm. And then I went and spent some time up north. I got fed up with acting. I went and spent some time up north playing music. Mm-hmm. And then I came back to acting when I was 30, and we have been able to resurrect my career as an actor and also a producer. And I did a year on One Tree Hill, and I've done a bunch of independent movies and produced a few movies. But it really was Voyager still that allowed me to resurrect my career. There was still respect and leftover from that has allowed me to keep working. Mm-hmm. So,
is that the sure. most? Do you get recognized for Voyager? Like, do people still recognize you as E-Chip?
More than anything else, yeah. Very strange, because I only did this really that in this movie called Go.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been in a bunch of things, and for some reason, people recognize me from Go. And I'm barely in the damn thing.
In the background, because you just say she's a retard.
That's what she said.
Yes.
I don't know why.
The un-PC Geek Apocalypse podcast.
Yeah. You know that's not PC to say that.
In England, that's quite an offensive word, yeah.
Yeah, that's an offensive word. You just said retard to all of England.
I'm Scottish. I'm a Leslie.
All right, no, it's okay. I'm fine. I'm all love, not hate. Don't worry about it.
Everybody that had special needs children, just totally ruined Valley.
I'm just saying.
Manu, on behalf of his roommate, is apologizing. No, I want to see. I'm just kidding. You'll understand English irony.
Well, that was the thing, though. I mean, what she meant was, I just had this small scene where I go out with Katie Holmes and Sarah Pauly, and I try to buy some drugs, mm-hmm. and they tell me that to lift up my shirt. And so I lift up my shirt because she's wondering if I'm wearing a wire, and she tells me to turn around, and I sort of dance around like an idiot, and then they hand me the drugs and I walk away, and it's like 15 seconds. And to this day, 20 years later, people are like, dude, are you from Go? And that happens all the time. I don't know why.
See, this is the beauty of podcasting, is that I had no idea that was going to be the answer, and that's interesting. I would never, if you'd gave me... You know, if I looked at your IMDb page, which I've had in the background the entire time, and I just went, "Oh, what is he most known for?" I would never have said that. You know, that's so interesting.
Yeah, me either. I don't know why people recognize me from that thing.
Awesome.
But and every once in a while, the One Tree Hill fan recognizes me too.
Yeah, I wanted to ask that because I know of the series. I haven't seen it. That's the Sophia Bush. Series, isn't it?
There's not a huge crossover from Star Trek fans to One Tree Hill fans.
Yeah. I didn't want to say, but yeah.
Stay on different sides of the television boat.
But I mean, it must be. I mean, but as an actor, though, it must be really nice. I mean, you talked earlier about being in J. Edgar. That the whole idea, isn't it, that you want to have different opportunities to play different people. You said that at the beginning of the show.
Yeah, I think that's what most of us aspire to, to try to get challenged and then to be character actors. I mean, there's character actors and then there's movie stars, and mm-hmm. I'd like to be either, to tell you the truth. but yeah, it's always more fun to me if you get a chance to play a character that has some real levels to them, whether it's an accent or some alcoholism or something, you know, or maybe he's got some sort of all my characters tend to be battling some sort of demon or some sort of chip on their shoulder, for lack of a better word.
Mm-hmm.
All of my characters have some sort of an edge, and I think that's sort of my shtick. Mm-hmm. Is I have a chip on my shoulder about being human and being alive, about everything. Mm-hmm. I'm a little angry.
Yeah.
But I have a huge heart, and so I tend to play these characters that are, you know, battling some sort of chip.
Obviously that's interesting, like, because I wanted to say, you know, again, I never want to assume things while being the host of this podcast, is to ask Is there any, do you use, I guess it's the term method acting, isn't it, where they you take experience from your own life. Is that kind of your process, or is it a different thing entirely?
Depending on the job. Okay. I've studied method, I've studied Uta Hagen, I've studied Meisner, which is not method acting, more about being natural, more about just being yourself in the scene, staying mm-hmm. natural for the camera, bringing yourself to the part, which... there's so many different schools of, there's actually not a ton of different schools of thought, but yeah. I've taken classes in a few of the different acting methods. And I think the right one is called for in the right place. Mm-hmm. You know, I think if you were playing a character like, that had like, you know, maybe a special way of talking and a bad neck and also he was from a particular part of the country and maybe he was a little bit gay too and you have to put all those things together. For that type of a role, you better stay in it. Mm-hmm. You better go method and you better find out exactly what your history is, study what that guy did for a living, whatever you can do to where he grew up, what his parents were like, whatever you can find out about him, and then don't break character, live in it. But if you're just playing someone that's very similar to you, I think it's detrimental to go method and a waste of time.
I just want to say before you continue that train of thought, Manu, I think we don't need to say anybody else. You're hired. That was a great audition. Everyone else cancel the rest of the day. We found that was really cool. I may or may not be using the video version of this podcast, so I might just put it up just for people to see the amazing acting skills that I saw all for 10 seconds. That was purely improvised, people. We did not prompt him in any way. That's awesome. So let's talk, I just want to ask you briefly, because you've mentioned it several times as I've been talking to you, about Fifth Passenger. Do you want to tell people what that is?
Oh, yeah, Fifth Passenger is the second time I produced a film, but the first time that we did a crowdfunding campaign to try to get it done. And mm-hmm. it's a thrilling little space story about five people that get stuck in a pod, in a space pod that's blown off a giant vessel. And they don't know where they're going. They don't have their directional array anymore. And it's a look at how society and mankind breaks down when you start to run out of food, water, and air. It's also got a little bit of an alien story mixed into it. It's like Alfred Hitchcock's Lifeboat in Space. I read this great script by this kid named Scott Baker. Mm-hmm. And... I loved the story, and so I told him, hey, let's get a few of my friends together. Let's try to raise a little bit of money for this, see if we can get this done. And we're almost finished. The fans were nice enough to put up $100,000. We ran a crowdfunder 3 weeks before. We only had 3 weeks to get it together, and the fans backed us, and we then had to match funds a number of times to and get more investors to finish the film. Mm-hmm. But right now we've finished the rough cut. It'll be out early in next year, most likely.
Great.
And I'm really proud of it. A great story. It stars Marina Sirtis, myself, Doug Jones, Armin Shimerman, Morgan LaRaya, and Tim Russ, and Herman Wilkins, and no, the other lead. I can't think of his name. Great actor, but I can't think of his name right now because it's been a while since I worked on it.
I'm on the IMDb page there, so I could help you if I choose to. But I can't remember if it's David Lim. David Lim.
David. Out of the blue, we were very lucky to find him.
That would have been so funny. I wanted to just continue your pain there and just make you think about it, but I'm going to be nice. No, but I mean, I honestly, I, people who listen to this know that I'm honest. I haven't heard of this, but it sounds very interesting.
Check it out. You can just go to www.fifthpassenger.com. And we have a trailer up. We have a new teaser we're going to release in the next couple months.
Oh, great.
And we'll have the release sometime early next year.
Do you know yet where it's going to be distributed?
We don't. We're assuming Sci-Fi has talked about us with some interest.
Oh, that's good.
They might make it, or it might go to release in theaters first. All I know is looking at the rough cut, we have a pretty damn good movie, so I'm sure we're going to be able to sell it to somebody that will get a good distribution for us.
Awesome. I will keep note of it. It sounds like something I would like.
It's Cronenbergish. The story is told from this perspective of a Memset, and I'll be very brief with it, but there's a thing on the ship called a Memset, mm-hmm. and the Memset records everybody's memories that's on the ship. Uh-huh. It's also a thing that while you're on the ship, if you are bored and you're stuck in deep space for a long time, you can put the Memset on and re-experience your memories from the past if you want to live somewhere else for a while. So when the movie starts, there's one survivor left from this pod that's been rescued, and we get to see the story through the memories of the person that is, she's kind of catatonic, and mm-hmm. Marina Sirtis plays this inspector that's trying to find out what happened on the pod. And so you never really know if you're watching a memory or if you're watching the movie or if you're watching real life. And it's got that Cronenberg sort of weird, out-of-order storytelling. I like that.
It's almost like reading a sort of crime novel or something. You're sort of trying to work it out as it's going. I always like that kind of thing. So, yeah, no, you've sold it to me. I'll definitely keep note of it. When did you say that was thinking you'd be ready by? Next year?
Yeah, probably early next year. Probably 3-4 months into the year, we'll get it out there.
Awesome. So that's Fifth Passenger. So people should make note. As you say, there's a website for that. So yeah, let's talk about the circuit, which obviously you're here to talk about. I'm very excited to hear about this. When Manu first got into contact with me, I obviously had a look at the Kickstarter, which has been going a few days now, as of this recording, I should say. So can you tell people, again, I'm going to do the Larry King of, I know nothing about this film. I'm a total idiot. I'm going to go back to my notes of the stereotypical notebook in front of me now. So Manu, I hear you've got a new project out now called The Circuit. Could you tell me a little bit more about that, please?
I'm really excited about this film. I've been going for 15 years. I've been going to on the convention circuit, and we talked a little bit earlier about living in this surreal world that is the convention community. Mm-hmm. I was talking to Walter Koenig a couple of years ago, and Walter and I wanted to do a project that somehow involved the fan base, because these people have supported our work for him 50 years. They've been interested in his life and his work, and for mm-hmm. me a good 20 years, and we wanted to do a project that excited us and at the same time could excite the fan base and involve the fan base, and we came up with this concept of, like I told you earlier, I was interested, and I'm a big fan of anthology TV series. And anthology films. Mm-hmm. I love in anthology films, if you don't know the definition, there's several stories that are told in the film. Mm-hmm. For instance, New York Stories or Parish of Tem. Those are all romantic stories that happen in a particular city. Mm-hmm. Then you've got the horror film anthologies like VHS that are just all horror stories, or Creepshow, or... and Twilight Zone, the movie, that are fantastical, fun stories that are tied together throughout the film by a thin story that's fun enough that keeps them the whole boat tied. So we thought what we would do is we would do 9 different genres, never been tried before.
Okay.
So a multi-genre anthology film that all took place in one central location, and that location would be a fictional mega convention. Mm-hmm. Mega Comic Con, Apollopolis, Paloozaville, Shire, Thon, whatever it's called. And so we would try to mix Twilight Zone the movie mm-hmm. with Galaxy Quest. And we would tell stories from the actors' perspectives, and we would tell stories from the fans' perspectives. Mm-hmm. And so we wrote 5 screenplays, all of separate genres, all that take place over the weekend of this massive convention. Mm-hmm. And we've been asking the fans to submit stories, 1 to 20 pages in screenplay format or short story format, and have them take place over the weekend of a pop culture convention.
Wow.
And we're going to do 9 stories tied together by a tenth and a couple of characters that make their way through a few of the stories. Mm-hmm. And it's a sort of complicated explanation for a real simple idea, which mm-hmm. is let's get actors, professional actors, writers and directors together. Let's make a bunch of different genre movies, but let's have them happen at the same location. And let's involve the fans as much as humanly possible. So if you go to the Circuit Kickstarter campaign and you pledge to the film, this is how we decided to involve the fans. Mm-hmm. If you pledge, one way you can get onto the film is you write a screenplay. If your screenplay gets selected, you get to come, you get writing credit, you get to stay there for the shoot, to watch your episode of the film get shot. But there's a million other ways to get involved. If you pledge to the Kickstarter, you can pledge to the Kickstarter at The Circuit on Kickstarter, mm-hmm. or at www.thecircuitfilm.com with PayPal if you don't want to use a credit card. Mm-hmm. Then immediately go and write me, manuentereme@thecircuitfilm.com, and submit your letter, your video, or your resume, or anything else you can think of to send me to tell me why and how you want to be a part of the film. And for every episode that the fans fund, we're going to bring on one fan per key department of the film to come collaborate and work on the film with us. So one person in wardrobe, one person in art department, one person in camera, one person in makeup, one mm-hmm. person, an actor, one person that will be an intern director behind the director and get to learn directing, in lighting, props, costumes, etc. Just tell me what part of filmmaking you're interested in and why we should pick you to join the project. Mm-hmm. And as long as you've pledged $5, which is the lowest pledge, all the way up to $10,000, we're not going to take the money into account. We're going to take into account the letters and the videos and just who convinces us they should come on board.
That sounds amazing. Like, yeah, I really like the sound of it. And just to save Manu the pain of trying to remember people who are involved in it, I mean, you've got some really cool people. I was actually reading earlier when you, pluck a name out from a hat, the Goran Nemec, who is Jonas Quinn. I've been rewatching a lot of Stargate recently, and he was, like, sort of, I guess, underutilized because, for those that aren't Stargate fans, Daniel Jackson came back, a.k.a. Michael Shanks, and the sort of Jonas became not as involved, but I thought he's a really, really good actor. And obviously JJ Hertzer, who's been on this podcast. You've got Ethan Phillips, Robert Ricardo, who I maintain to this day is one of the nicest people in the world. And Tim Russell, you mentioned earlier, is involved in it, and it sounds amazing. So
we have Sylvester McCoy,
yeah, Walter Koenig, Terry Farrell.
Sylvester McCoy was the Hobbit. He was the Radagast the Brown.
Yeah, I've met him actually. Yeah, he does the convention circuit in the UK. Yeah, he's really nice.
Yeah, one of the most popular Doctor Who's, hilarious guy. Yeah. We've got Terry Farrell, Olivia Diabo, Mindy Robinson.
Wow,
all just fantastic. We've got Miltos Yaramello from Game of Thrones. Mm-hmm. The idea was to put a cast together since we're doing a multi-genres. And of course we want to do the genres that convention fans love the most. So we want to do a sci-fi epic. We want to do a fantasy. We want to do a supernatural story. We want to do a period piece. And then people wonder, well, how the heck are you going to do that at a convention? Mm-hmm. Well, they don't have to take place on the convention floor. You could get to the convention and a character could go into their hotel room, step into a different dimension, and suddenly they're in medieval England. And we can have a lot of fun with this. The idea for having it all take place at a convention was because conventions are where we go to celebrate the genres we love. Mm-hmm. So it felt like the magical location to be able to make all these things in. We're going to do a zombie episode where a zombie outbreak happens at a convention. And so all these stories of different genres, the edges of them will touch in little funny ways. So when we're doing our drama, maybe a couple of the vampires from the vampire episode that you saw 40 minutes before in the movie mm-hmm. will make their way through that episode in a cute little way, sort of like Sin City or Pulp Fiction ties itself together. You know, these characters bump into each other slightly. And I thought that would be so fun to be able to have all these genres exist in one place and be happening in one place. Independent of each other. And then for the super genre fans, the whole storyline that ties it all together is a time travel story. So
Marty McFly.
So yeah.
Yeah, like
Back to the Future going on too, and multiple realities and multiple dimensions, and they're all taking place within this one pop culture event. Walter came up with half of the idea. I came up with the idea. We thought this would be a blast. This is the way, I think if anybody can pull this project off, it's the sci-fi convention fan community. And if we're going to be successful, they're going to have to support it, because it's way too radical of an idea for the studio to take a look at without us filming at least a pilot episode.
Yeah, I imagine, so, like, if we did, like, an improv scene now where I'm, like, ahead of some, film... a film production company or something. Like, say I'm 21st Century Fox. I think the first, like, opening sentence you did, I think the person, if I was a stereotypical, I would have just went, what?
Yeah.
Like, you know?
Multi-genre anthology film, those don't happen.
Yeah.
That's
you're insane. Been. Goodbye.
That's true. They did Buffy the Musical.
Yeah, that's true.
Buffy the Musical, but in exactly that way, we're going to like Buffy the Musical, right? We'll have fun with twisting genres on their head.
Yeah, I like the sound of that. That sounds actually I like the idea of, and I guess, you know, I think I'm assuming you think this is fair to say, is that I'm kind of excited to see if you could pull it off.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, it's just, it seems like something that doesn't go together, but I can see from a convention point of view, because I'll ask you directly, because you're a convention goer. Conventions, for those of the people who haven't went, I'm assuming quite a lot of people listen to this have, is that it is as mad as it sounds. So, I mean, you know, the fact that you've put it in the convention setting gives it some credibility.
Make it even weirder, right?
Yes.
We can make it even weirder. So to help people understand, maybe two actors that you know and love, that they've known each other on the series that they've been on, and we would nod our hat to the series, of course. We wouldn't, but you would know what series we were talking about, even though we wouldn't say it, are on their way to a convention. And on the way to the convention, they find out that one of them has actually never been an actor, but he has been put on, say, Galaxy Hike, because, or Universe Walk, or if you get my drift, to actually work for the CIA and go around to all these conventions and make hits for the government while he's there. And the other actor finds out about this and exposes him, and these two friends have to decide whether they're going to kill each other. And then one of them is like, well, hey, if you help me, maybe you could join the Black Ops community. And they have to do this horrible thing on the way to the convention. They get there, and then the other one of them is KGB, and he's not CIA at all. And then all of a sudden you find out that all these genre actors maybe work for the spy community. And so that gets your brain ticking. And then that story, the camera pans off it, sort of like Birdman, if you ever saw Birdman, and
comes down to
the convention floor where, let's say, we have Cody St. New. And Cody St. New is the kid from MTV's Teen Wolf. And he's been invited, and it wouldn't be Teen Wolf, it would be Dog Boy or whatever. We're not taking any other IPs. We're not showing Star Trek or Star Wars or any of that stuff.
Yes.
It's got to be its own thing, just like Galaxy Quest did.
Yes.
And he's been invited to this convention, and what his agent doesn't know is that he actually is a frickin' werewolf. And it's the full moon that weekend. And Cody doesn't know that. And he doesn't know he's a werewolf, but he's been one for these last few years. And so, like, we can do all of that kind of fun stuff. And usually when I tell, I could think of a million stories that could take place at this place.
Yeah.
That starts to make it clearer for people. So it really is Twilight Zone, but the Twilight Zone is the convention circuit.
Brilliant. Is the convention, I guess, as you touched on, like, you know, intellectual property is always an issue, but is it going to be a made-up convention as well?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a fictional mega convention that's like the 50th. This year also is the 50th anniversary of the convention scene
exactly,
as far as media goes.
Yeah.
So it's the 50 years ago. there were sci-fi conventions before that, but they were literary. Uh-huh. And as soon as Roddenberry showed his pilot episodes at this convention in New Jersey, people sort of traced back the start of the media sci-fi pop culture convention to then.
Yeah.
So we also wanted to celebrate 50 years of behind the scenes stories. So we're going to sprinkle in a little bit of truth with a lot of fiction, and that's going to be part of the fun of watching this episodic anthology film is how much of this is real.
Yeah, yeah. No, that sounds exciting. I've just been aware that we've been talking for about an hour and a half, so I don't want to take up much more of your time. I could talk to you forever. I just wanted to ask in terms of the circuit, just obviously I'll mention obviously in the introduction where people can donate and stuff like that, and I know you've mentioned it already. It's just to say I often have not all the time, but we've had a certain number of people who kickstart things, and from board games to independent films like yourself and all that kind of stuff. And so I'm intrigued to ask you, as someone who's kind of got involved in that process and being an actor who's been on major TV shows and have guest appearances and all that kind of thing, I always enjoy the question of the transition that it seems to be going through, or like a different, or maybe the right word is it's a different opportunity for actors like yourself to get work and to do, you know, like we just touched on, an idea that might be something a mainstream distributor might go, I don't understand that, that's too niche or something like that. So from your point of view, getting involved in the sort of Kickstarter crowdfunding, the fans have a say, type deal, how do you feel about that experience and sort of the way sort of filmmaking is heading in that sense?
I think it's awesome. What has to happen though is that the people that there's a lot of people that I mean, I found this frustrating because I'm a professional producer and actor, and I've been in this business for 20 years, and I put people in my project that have made, I mean, some of my producers on this project and visual effects artists did Spider-Man 2 and Iron Man and Planes, and they worked on mega films. Mm-hmm. A lot of people that have had some mega success in the Kickstarter field haven't been able to maintain their integrity and then still make the movie that they said they were going to make with the money. Mm-hmm. And if that continues to happen, then the whole thing will die.
Yes.
So I would just sort of, my concern, I think it's an amazing idea. It's democratic. You get to pitch your idea to the people that are actually going to watch it. And then they can, what people don't understand a lot about Kickstarter is movies are really, really expensive.
Yes.
And so what people can do with Kickstarter is our whole film is going to cost $1.5 million to make.
Yes.
But if we make our initial goal of $200,000, as a producer in Hollywood, if you don't have some names in your movie and a good idea and some money, mm-hmm. it's really hard to go around and find investors that are willing to go, oh, you're real, I'll play ball with you and I'll match your funds, or I'll invest twice of what you're investing. Mm-hmm. So just getting to that couple hundred thousand dollars can allow you to raise the 1.5.
Yes.
Whereas if you just have a script and an idea, good luck. Mm-hmm. And so that's sort of the beautiful thing about Kickstarter, is even when you don't make your entire goal, you actually do kickstart the project. So it's just like Fifth Passenger, we raised 1/4 of what we needed, but that was enough for us to have $100,000 to go to somebody else in that community of wealthy people.
Yeah.
And we have $100,000 that we're going to throw at this, and here's why. And then we were able to find other people that were willing to do the
same. Because I guess, is it fair to say the reason people react that way is because, say for example, you have a really, really great idea, but as you say, you don't have the money to implement it, then a person who's going to invest in your thing might turn around and say, well, anyone can come up with a good idea and a good premise, but if you haven't got the money, then it's sort of you're on the same playing field as sort of everybody else, if you see what I mean, to a degree. Whereas if you have, to your argument, say 100,000, you can go, well, some people like it, or we've invested some of it, and so if you, it's like you're meeting them halfway. Is that kind of fair to say?
Yeah, and meeting them halfway, and the fans have already sort of declared that they want to see this.
Yes.
And so that's also just what I want to get across to the fan base, is that if they don't get excited about teaming up with us to go make their movie and our story at the same time, then nobody's gonna. This is our one opportunity to get this crazy project off the ground. All of these amazing actors, writers, and directors have signed on. We want to do it. We want to do it cheap. We want to work just for the passion of making this thing. Mm-hmm. And hopefully the fan base wants to come and join us. Also, I should just tell people, of course, to follow us at The Circuit Movie on all the social media.
Yes.
We've got a bunch of great teasers and trailers up. We're releasing them every week. And At The Circuit Film is our website. And, of course, if you want to support us on Kickstarter, that's the most important thing, is the amount of people that get behind this. And that's what I'm trying to get all of my cast to do, as many interviews. Thank you, for example, for having these podcasts that allow us to reach out, mm-hmm. And tell people about the projects. They wouldn't happen if it weren't for a real team getting together.
Yeah.
I was really inspired by not only the Fifth Passenger experience, but 2 months ago I met Adam Nimoy and watched For the Love of Spock come out.
Yeah.
And when For the Love of Spock came out, I was lucky enough to, one of the producers from that came on board The Circuit, and I'm really trying to twist Adam's arm to come on board and direct one of our episodes that isn't in writing yet, but I really want it to happen. Mm-hmm. But what's neat is to sit in his theater when he, in LA, he showed For the Love of Spock for the first time at the Paramount Theater, and there was 700 and something people in the crowd. A lot of them had given money to the campaign. And then it was a powerful, powerful film, emotional and beautiful, about this man's father, who we all know is Spock. And then for 6.5 minutes after the movie, you got to see everybody's name they put everybody's name in the credits that supported the Kickstarter.
Yeah.
And that was really inspiring, and people sat through the credits just because of that. You know, mm. It was like, we all did this together. And you got that sense and I so want to be a part of something big like that. And
is it fair, can I ask you, like, I mean this with all sincerity, because I guess I'm really intrigued just to know, especially if you're on mainstream films, and you have a certain experience in that, is that I always sometimes feel, I've heard other actors say this, is that mainstream films can be a very passive experience, and that it's like, as you were touching on earlier with some examples in TV, is that you kind of go there and you say the lines and all this kind of stuff, whereas I guess what you're saying in regards to Kickstarter, because I so understand what you mean, when I've like donated the stuff, is the like camaraderie and the sense of that you're all involved in it, and even in a small way. And I just think, I've heard some stories about when you're in I guess because sometimes mainstream films can be so big that you maybe don't feel that you're contributing in a way, whereas this like is a small but very passionate amount of people involved. Is that something you agree with?
Yeah, sure. I mean, there's an agenda also behind a lot of mainstream stuff.
Yeah.
It's being produced for $160 million. So they have to get all this stuff in there for instance, I watched the new Jurassic Park, and I swear to God, I saw the Mercedes symbol in that movie.
Yeah, that came out today. They're making the new one. Yeah.
50 something times, and Starbucks and McDonald's and every other. It was like this full on corporate advertisement.
And Dominus Rex.
And I don't know. I don't want to make a movie that's all about selling people Pepsi and cars. And
that happened. I mean, I was trying to think. I saw. I think I'm right in saying, in the basis of that, I haven't actually seen the latest Jurassic Park, but I heard, I think through an article or reading an article or something, that it is one of the most product placed films.
It was undeniable. Yeah. I mean, it's like,
they even joke about it in the film.
All right, do they? That's even worse, because they clearly would have got money to put them in a certain amount of shots, I'm assuming.
You could do a drinking game on the amount of time that you see Mercedes symbols pop up in the movie. I swear it's like every 2 or 3 minutes.
Can you watch it? Because I'm not kidding. They actually talk about it when they're in the control room. Mm-hmm. He goes, why not just let
why just not call it one? Called the Pepsi-saurus?
And he's or like, Pepsi-saurus, Verizon Wireless.
Verizon Wireless.
Wow. Do you think that was like sort of a slight dig? Like, this the amount? Like,
yeah, maybe.
Yeah, they legit say it.
Like, have you guys ever seen a film called, I watched this recently because I went through a phase of watching like a lot of Michael Bay stuff. Have you ever seen The Island?
Yeah, I like The Island.
Yeah, it's a good film, but I rewatched it recently because I think it's a really underappreciated film. And then,
and Ethan Phillips, one of our super guests.
Yeah, that's actually why I thought of it while you were talking. Yep. Is, because he has a small part in it, but he's in it for a fair bit. And because he's the guy who wins the lottery. Yeah, that's it. Yeah,
yeah, gets to go to the island.
Yeah, he gets to go. Yeah, and he's like dead excited. But anyway, that's another classic example of I rewatched that, and then I suddenly, because I'd seen it when it first came out, like 10 years ago or something, and I rewatched it recently and found myself going, "Man, there's a lot of product placement in this."
And that's what all mega movies are now, and they're selling not only products, but they're also selling a certain agenda.
Yes,
and it's not fun to be a part of that. Mm.
And also, do you think it's fair to say? And I'm not trying to. I'm not being controversial. I'm just intrigued to know what you think. I also think it's kind of sad in a way that you mentioned Jurassic Park, which is a remake. They're scared of original ideas.
Big time.
Yeah.
They're totally scared of original ideas, and especially investing big money in original ideas. So they just what was this year? Ghostbusters and Ben-Hur. Seriously, you're gonna try to remake Ghostbusters, the most perfect freaking film.
If they remake something like Casablanca, I think I'm just going to give up entirely.
Exactly, yeah. And they will. If they remake Ben-Hur, Casablanca's next.
Oh, God.
You can't remake Ben-Hur. What do you do?
I don't get it. And it's just like, I think they're missing the point. And I think to put a positive spin on this, and I assume you're going to agree in what I'm about to say, is that I think that's one of the huge benefits of when you see certain independent films become as successful on stuff like Kickstarter, is because you're going to reach a point, I think, and it's kind of good in a way, because I think it'll make these sort of mainstream distribution companies and people who make films of that level stop pissing off the fans to a degree, because they're going to go to independent stuff and say, I'm not going to spend money on stuff where my, like, in some cases, I think I would go as far as to say your intelligence is insulted. Where it's just like, and also I don't know whether you agree with this, but I see far too many films where the special effects is just, it's always special effects orientated.
All
in the
effects, explosions.
Yeah. Like Superman, I don't know, I can give you an example of that, like Batman versus Superman, Man of Steel, where it's just, it's quite interesting in terms of him becoming Superman, and then it just becomes a fight where it's just, how many buildings can we throw Superman through? And I'm just like, they just don't care enough about plot anymore. It's just like, we'll try and give you an experience, but not realizing the experience is to be emotionally invested.
And that's, to spin it back around to what I'm making.
Exactly, yeah, no, go for it, yeah.
My whole thing is story. I want to tell 9 really good genre stories. Right. And get to make different types of films. And if you don't have a great story, then you don't have a movie. You just, like you said, you have an experience. And there isn't a whole lot of films that I've seen that have been able to succeed with entertaining me for 2 hours with visual effects.
No, couldn't agree more. What a great way to end. I think that's a very good way. Good way to wrap it up. Is to say, Manu, this was really, really fun. I had an awesome time.
Yeah. But the fans, too, that are out there bitching about no new content, you have a chance. Help us out. Oh, pledge. $5 counts. It's about numbers of people donating and not what they donate.
Yes.
And don't forget to go to thecircuitfilm.com afterwards and write us and tell us how you want to join us, because that's what this film's about.
Indeed, too. Yeah. So if you type in The Circuit on Kickstarter, you'll see the project. I'll make sure I put a link and stuff for people who are interested to. So if they want to be ultra ultra lazy, all you have to do is click a mouse button and you're there.
And I also I should explain too that we can't put it on the Kickstarter website because they call it a contest and they don't allow it. They call it a raffle for us to include people in the movie. Mm-hmm. So it's why I'm trying to get it out through the press is we can't put it on the Kickstarter page. If you go to the www.thecircuitfilm.com, you'll see what we're trying to do.
Okay.
But if you go to the Kickstarter page, it doesn't explain that you can go and submit to be a part of this movie.
So that's a really, you know what it is? I'm actually really glad you said that, because as someone who's spent the time talking to you, I read the Kickstarter obviously earlier. And I've sort of been flicking through it as we've been talking, and yeah, I never said anything like that. And I was like, that seems like a very good point to raise. And so thank you for saying that. That made, I was really not sure. Yeah.
Put it there. It's been sort of the most frustrating thing about this is Kickstarter said, well, you can't do that. And mm-hmm. I was like, well, can we do that on our website? Can we do that in the press? Yeah, but on Kickstarter, we don't allow contests like that. And I was like, well, shoot.
Cool. Well, I wish you every success with it. I hope people who are listening to this would consider donating to it. It would be very, very appreciative. As of right now, if people are interested, as of this recording, I'm thinking about putting this out on Friday, as we're recording this on a Tuesday technically for me, still a Monday for Manu. It's currently got 197 backers and it's doing quite well. So, and it's only been going a few days. Yeah, 27 days it's got left. So, plenty of time.
Yes. But we need pledges now.
Yes. Yes, donate now. Yes, if you could send your, if you could send your carrier pigeons and your, and your wishful thinking to the circuit. But no, seriously, Manu, I've had a really great time and, I tried very hard not to geek out about the fact I got to talk to a person from Voyager, so I hope I did a good job.
Yeah, it was great. It was very fun. Thank you, man.
No problem at all. So I'll say goodbye properly, and then I'll talk to you. I'll just say bye unofficially afterwards. But yeah, huge thank you to Manu. I really did enjoy it. Obviously, Egypt from Star Trek Voyager, but he was obviously here to talk about the circuit. As he mentioned, please do go to thecircuitfilm.com and the circuit on Kickstarter, and obviously follow them on the social medias and all that kind of thing, and obviously do consider donate. But I've been Steven. This has been the Geek Partners Podcast. I'll end the podcast like I always end, in the words of the great B-movie robot jocks, Crash and Burn. And we'll see you very soon for another edition of the Geek Bottles Podcast. Thanks, guys. Bye. Okay. You can say bye if you want.
Right. Yeah. Adios, everybody. Thanks for listening. I had a good time.
Perfect.
Toodaloo.